Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Michael Korda, who reads from and discusses his new biography, Ike, published by HarperCollins. In the weeks to come, we have Terry Pratchett, Whitley Strieber, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, it is my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting independent bookselling. We are so honored to have Michael Korda with us tonight to present his stunning new book, Ike, an American Hero, the first single-volume biography of Dwight Eisenhower to appear in many years. In this compelling and highly readable epic, Michael gives us a new portrait of this American figure, one that is frank, revealing, and also gives fresh attention to his wife, Mamie Eisenhower, herself from Denver. During his 35 years as editor-in-chief at Simon & Schuster, Michael Korda spent many years putting authors on the New York Times bestseller list, so it is only natural that many of his own books have landed on this esteemed list, including Journey to a Revolution, Horse People, Country Matters, a book about his life in Dutchess County, New York, with his wife, where he lives with his wife and horses. His novel Queenie, Charmed Lives, and Ulysses S. Grant. And it is good also to know that this, his latest book, has also taken up roost on the New York Times list. We are so glad to welcome a man with such expertise and knowledge of the publishing industry, a man and writer who exudes an obvious passion for books. Please give a warm welcome to Michael Korda.
Thank you.
I'm particularly happy to be in Denver because Mamie came from here. The Dowds played a very large role in Ike's life and continued to do so throughout his life, even when he was president. I'm also happy because Ike himself visited Denver often, liked it, lived here for a time when he was president, and it contained many of the things that he liked best: climate, places to play golf, good steaks. Let me begin by saying that there's a reason for writing a biography of Dwight D. Eisenhower, and there is also a good reason to read it. Ours is neither a nation nor a culture given to extended hero worship. Ralph Waldo Emerson understood his own countrymen only too well when he wrote, "Every hero becomes a bore at last." After all, within Emerson's own lifetime, he would see both Andrew Jackson and Ulysses S. Grant cut down to size. There is simply no place in American life for the enduring national cult of the hero, no equivalent of France's fierce national passion for Napoleon, a cult, strangely, by no means limited to France, or England's sentimental hero worship of Nelson and increasingly of Winston Churchill. Perhaps it is the price of being a democracy and of a deep inherent distrust of the very idea of an elite. Americans are all egalitarians at heart, or at least feel obliged to pay homage to the idea. We have a natural tendency to nibble away at the great figures of our past, to cut them down to size, to dig through their lives for flaws, mistakes, and weaknesses, to judge them severely by the standards and beliefs of the present rather than those that prevailed when they were alive. Thus, Washington has been marginalized as a, quote, dead white male, as well as a slave owner, remembered more for his ill-fitting false teeth or for the story of the cherry tree than for his generalship. Thus, Jefferson has been downgraded from his lofty position as the author of the Declaration of Independence to being treated as yet another slave owner and also a spendthrift and a hypocrite. Thus, Grant's tomb sits forlorn and seldom visited on Riverside Drive and 122nd Street in New York City, despite the fact that it was, until the beginning of the First World War, a bigger tourist attraction than the Statue of Liberty. It is a simple fact of American life, this urge to splash graffiti on the pantheon of our national heroes. In other countries or cultures, the building up of national heroes is a full-time job, respected and well-rewarded. In France, with membership in the Académie Française and Légion d'honneur. In the United Kingdom, with knighthoods and a cozy place in the cultural establishment. While in ours, whole profitable segments of the media and publishing industries prosper by tearing them down. Sic transit gloria mundi might as well be our national motto. Already in his own lifetime, for example, Dwight D. Eisenhower underwent a rapid transition from world-class five-star hero status to being dismissed by many as out of touch with what was happening in the country, more interested in his golf score than in politics, deaf or at least hard of hearing to the pleas of civil rights leaders, and towards the end of his 8 years in office, overshadowed by the youth and glamour of Jack Kennedy. The 1950s, the Eisenhower years, still conjure up to most people a world that seems far removed from our own, even to those who came of age in it. Men wearing hats with narrow brims, suits with narrow lapels, huge great tail fin cars gleaming with chrome and guzzling cheap gas, the dizzyingly rapid growth of the suburbs, the fiction of women as happy, contented housewives, McCarthyism, the height of the Cold War, the threat of nuclear warfare, the missile gap, an age when cigarettes weren't considered harmful, the pill had yet to be invented, hemlines ended below the knee, and when conformity, at least on the surface, ruled the country. Ike, as he was referred to by everyone, presided over this now vanished America, benign, avuncular, occasionally exasperated. His idea of a good evening was said to be watching old westerns on television, the president and Mrs. Eisenhower seated side by side in front of the set with a television tray for each of them. His idea of a good meal, a scotch on the rocks, and a rare steak. Although Ike, with his big trademark grin, looked like a gregarious soul, this was in part a facade, a protective mechanism, like a lot of things about him. True, he had grown up poor in Abilene, Kansas, but he was also a West Pointer, a five-star general and a former Supreme Commander, a man who, to quote Kipling, had walked with kings nor lost the common touch, and dealt as an equal with Churchill, Roosevelt, Stalin, and de Gaulle. Decades after serving two terms as his vice president, Richard Nixon, whom I edited for several books, was still complaining to anyone who would listen, including myself, how seldom the Eisenhowers had ever invited the Nixons to a cozy private dinner at the White House, just the four of them together, a subject about which Mrs. Nixon often expressed to the very end of her life what was for her a very rare degree of resentment. It has become conventional wisdom to believe that Ike's heart wasn't in politics, that like another victorious American general, Ulysses S. Grant, he accepted the presidency more out of a sense of obligation and as a reward for victory rather than from any desire to run the country. But this is untrue, part of the Ike myth. The real Ike was a supremely gifted politician with an intimate knowledge of Washington and how it works, gained in part from serving 7 years as General Douglas MacArthur's military aide. He was also fiercely ambitious and competitive, with a carefully honed gift for concealing the fact. He had a terrifying hair-trigger temper, despite the big smile and the firm handshake, and a brilliant first-rate mind which he did his best to hide, partly out of genuine modesty, partly because he had learned how to play poker from a master as a boy in his teens. Indeed, throughout his long career in uniform, he was widely recognized as the best poker and bridge player in the United States Army in an age when that mattered. And not surprisingly, for a soldier, he could curse and did curse like a trooper. My friend Henry Kissinger, also an author, many of whose books I've edited and published, still remembers today and told me last week at dinner in Connecticut, being on the receiving end of a diatribe from Ike over the phone when he was Nixon's national security advisor. Shortly after reaching the White House, Nixon had sent Kissinger to Ike's hospital, where he was in the throes of deep heart problems that would eventually kill him, to explain to Ike what Nixon's foreign policy would be and to sound out Ike's view on the judge, on those policies. Kissinger had been struck by how enormously well-informed, intelligent, and sensible Ike's point of view was. And when he arrived at his desk the next morning, early in the morning at 7:30 a.m., he was astonished when the phone rang and he picked it up, and it was Eisenhower from his hospital room cursing Kissinger at the top of his voice. And I will try and do justice to Henry. Henry said, "Never, never, never in my entire life has anybody ever spoken to me like that. He cursed me for 5 or 6 minutes nonstop. He never stopped for breath. I heard words which I had never heard ever in my life before in English. Finally, I apologized to him and hung up." Turned out that what Ike had told Kissinger appeared that morning on the front page of the Washington Post. And Ike assumed that Kissinger had leaked it to the Washington Post and was furious that that Kissinger had thereby betrayed Nixon. Although the truth was, if Henry is to be believed, that it was Nixon who leaked it to the Washington Post and Kissinger was innocent. Nevertheless, Kissinger says with his hand on his heart, that to hear Ike swear was to hear something altogether extraordinary. And this is borne out by others. When Ike descended, even as a second lieutenant, on a soldier whom he thought was not doing what his duty was or was improperly dressed, his face turned this color, purple red. The veins in his temple throbbed. He had these cold blue eyes, and you knew you were going to get, to put it bluntly, your ass reamed, and no doubt about it. Ike's temper was amazing. None other than General George S. Patton remarked that the only person apart from Mrs. Patton who made him quake at the knees was Ike when he was angry. And Ike was often angry at Patton and had reason to be. And Ike let go at Omar Bradley during the Battle of the Bulge the winter of 1944, in a burst of temper that took Omar Bradley by such surprise that he was still telling people about it 15 years later. So we are looking at a very different man from the genial, avuncular, smiling man that was sold to us by Republican publicists when Ike finally decided to run for the presidency. There is more even to Ike's skill as a card player than meets the eye. For Ike came on his father's side from solid Mennonite stock, bearded German-speaking farmers, not unlike their neighbors in Pennsylvania, the Amish, black-hatted with wide brims, black frock coats down to the knees, big stout boots. They prayed in Germany even when they spoke to their neighbors in English, and were, of course, against card playing, liquor, or smoking. Not against it. It was simply not allowed in their homes. And were, above all, absolutely scrupulous and determined pacifists to a man. Indeed, the reason why so many Mennonites, including Ike's formidable grandfather, ended up in Abilene, Kansas, a former cattle town, was that their neighbors in Pennsylvania were not enthralled during the Civil War by the fact that the Mennonites were pro-Lincoln, pro-Union, anti-slavery, but of course refused to join the army or let their children join the army. So it was with some dispatch that the Mennonites moved to Abilene after the end of the Civil War. Ike's beloved mother, not only converted to Mennonism in order to marry his father, but wore a prayer cap for a long time and a prayer apron and a dress button to the neck when she was married. Never showed hair. The prayer cap always concealed it. And converted a second time in midlife to becoming a Jehovah's Witness, a religion which also condemns card playing and is even more devoted to complete pacifism than the Mennonites are. So this is already a fascinating part of Ike's story. How did the boy from Abilene grow up to attend the United States Military Academy and become a soldier and make war for his career? As late as the Second World War, his mother lived on into great old age. His mother still found it impossible to explain to the other Jehovah's Witnesses how it was that she had allowed her son to join the army, and was very ambivalent about Ike's success as a general, since it involved killing people. Needless to say, that, together with the fact that Ike supported himself as a second lieutenant on his poker winnings at West Point, is one of the many mysteries in his life for biography to explore. Sufficient to say, it is a great story and not a simple one. One of the saddest things about the way our country no longer learns or teaches its own history, let alone anybody else's, is that everybody of any consequence in it gets ruthlessly oversimplified and distorted. Some attention is paid to Lincoln's psychological complexity because he is our national martyr. But what do people, even supposedly well-educated people, really know today about Woodrow Wilson or Franklin Delano Roosevelt or Dwight D. Eisenhower? Let us begin with the obvious. With the possible exception of Grant, Ike was the best general this country ever produced. He planned and led not one, but three enormous, unprecedented, and ultimately successful amphibious invasions of North Africa in 1942, of Sicily in 1943, and of Normandy in 1944. We must remember, too, that while history gives us, if nothing else, a window to the past, those who are living through it have no equivalent clear view ahead. Germany was at the peak of her power in 1942, and there seemed no good reason why Hitler should not win the war. Victory was not a sure thing. It took Ike 6 months and cost 70,000 casualties to win in Tunisia. The Germans fought fiercely in Sicily, despite the collapse of their Italian ally, and D-Day was the narrowest triumph and might have turned into a disaster. It was Ike's task to destroy the armed forces of Nazi Germany, an army that was still second to none in experience, professional skill, and fighting spirit, and driven by a level of fanaticism that was still a formidable asset. Because we look backwards at Ike's victories, we tend to assume that they were inevitable, but they were nothing of the sort. Nor was Ike just a successful general. He was a supreme commander, leading a coalition of fractious and difficult allies to victory, the hardest job in warfare. We now live in an age when a four-star general commands perhaps 160,000 troops in the field in Iraq. In June of 1944, Ike commanded over 3 million men, 1.7 million of them American, 1 million of them British and Canadian, the rest Free French, Polish, Norwegian, Czech, Belgian, and Dutch. Not since the Duke of Wellington in 1815, before the Battle of Waterloo, had one man commanded such an international force. It was, in fact, the largest and most complicated international alliance in history, and surely the most formidable. Ike had under his command over 11,000 aircraft, 7,000 ships. He had 170,000 men already at sea as he sat down at 9:30 p.m. on the night of June 4th, 1944, in the middle of continuing bad weather and high seas, to make the final decision as to whether to carry out the invasion of Europe on June 6th or postpone until later in the month or even to July. He was supreme commander, Allied forces in Europe. It was his decision and his alone to make. He was under no obligation to consult with anyone, nor did he. Ike's orders simply read, and I quote, "You will enter the continent of Europe, and in conjunction with the other United Nations, undertake operations aimed at the heart of Germany and the total destruction of her armed forces. As Ike sat chain-smoking, 40 a day, in the library of Southwark House near Portsmouth, listening to the wind and the rain rattle the blacked-out windows, the full responsibility for the most momentous and critical decision of World War II rested entirely on his shoulders. The meteorologists had given their forecast. His ground commander, General Sir Bernard Montgomery, had given his opinion, as had his naval commander, Admiral Sir Bertram Ramsay, his air commander, Air Chief Marshal Sir Trafford Leigh Mallory, and his deputy, Air Chief Marshal Sir Arthur Tedder. There was nothing more to learn or say. Ike did not call Washington for advice or orders on the scrambler phone. He sat in silence, smoking for almost 3 minutes. Those who were present remembered the ticking of a clock in the room. Then, slowly, he said, "I am quite positive I must give the order. I don't like it, but there it is. I don't see how I can do anything else." Then, as his subordinate commanders rushed off to the telephones and the telex machines, Ike stood up and left the room. He had given the order. The invasion would now take place on the morning of June 6th, and nothing on earth could stop it. And he went back through the rain to the simple trailer where he lived and sat down to write on a small piece of paper with his fountain pen what he would say to the press the next morning if the invasion failed. He wrote, quote, "Our landings in the Cherbourg-Avre area have failed to gain a satisfactory foothold, and I have withdrawn the troops. My decision to attack at this time and place was based on the best information available to me. The troops, the air, the navy, did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone." He folded this note up and put it in the breast pocket of his short uniform jacket, it was already becoming known as an Eisenhower jacket, and buttoned the pocket so he would know where to find it if he needed it in the morning. As we all know, he did not need it. The chances of the invasion succeeding, he rated it no better than 50-50. It was the greatest gamble of the war, but Ike brought it off, and the note was never read. There is, however, in this glimpse of Ike, everything that made him a great commander and an American hero. Humility, the strength to accept crushing responsibility, the willingness to admit it when he made a mistake, the courage to do what looked like the impossible and to do it with a grin that made it look easy. It is easy now to forget the battles he fought and won, about how he turned a humiliating defeat in Tunisia into a victory, at one point advancing himself towards a German attack with his pistol drawn, perhaps the only full general to do such a thing in the history of both world wars. It is easy now to forget about how hard that war was and how much of it was fought under Ike's command. The near thing at Salerno, when the Allied armies were almost driven off the beaches by the sheer ferocity of the German counterattack, and when destroyers came in so close to the shore that they fought gun battles with German Tiger tanks on the beaches, until the tubes of the destroyers' guns turned red hot. It is easy to forget about the Battle of Saint-Lô and the closing of the Falaise Gap, when men advanced over thousands of corpses. About the liberation of Paris and the airborne drop on Arnhem and the Battle of the Bulge and the crossing of the Rhine at Remagen. In each of these battles, all through the tragedies and catastrophes of war, Ike kept his cool, retained and communicated to all his soldiers, whatever their rank, his optimism, stuck to his plans, dealt with such difficult subordinates as Monty and George Patton, chose and defended against such vehement prima donnas as Winston Churchill, Charles de Gaulle, and Stalin, his strategy for victory, and in the end achieved just what he had promised to do when he accepted the German surrender at Reims and addressed a German general for the first and only time in the Second World War, telling Colonel General Jodl, quote, "You will officially and personally be held responsible if the terms of this surrender are violated, including its provision for German commanders to appear in Berlin at the moment set by the Russian High Command to accomplish the formal surrender to that government. That is all. You are dismissed." He then sat down and dictated a cable to Washington, with the shortest, most personally modest, and least triumphalist vestige of victory since that of Grant's from Appomattox. Quote, the mission of this Allied force was fulfilled at 0241, local time, May 7th, 1945, signed Eisenhower. Ike went on from that great victory to become president of Columbia University, the architect and the first supreme commander of NATO, and eventually president of the United States. As president, he ended the war in Korea with an armistice that is still in place 56 years later. He guided the country through the dangers of the Cold War. He kept the peace for 8 years. He presided over the rebuilding of Europe. And when challenged by Governor Orville Forbes of Arkansas over the Supreme Court decision requiring the end of school segregation, Ike rejected the use of U.S. Marshals, police officers, and FBI agents, and instead, unhesitatingly, used the fully armed troopers of the 101st Airborne, one of the airborne divisions that had dropped on Normandy at his orders on the night of June the 5th, to escort black students through angry mobs into the high school in Little Rock. Ike wanted peace, yearned and worked for it at home and abroad, but he knew that when the United States was obliged to use force, whether it was in Little Rock or in Normandy, it must be maximum irresistible force with the moral backing and the involvement of all Americans in support of a well-thought plan for total victory. He is best summed up, I think, in his own words, that are as important today as they were nearly 50 years ago when he was president, and should perhaps be studied with some attention by those in office and even by those who aspire to the Oval Office. On the subject of defense, for example, Ike said, every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, represents in the final analysis a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, who are cold and not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. How few generals, how few presidents since have ever spoken so eloquently on the subject of defense spending as that. On the subject of Vietnam, Ike said, no one could be more bitterly opposed to ever getting the United States involved in a hot war in that region than I am. I could not conceive of a greater tragedy for America. On the subject of Social Security, the boy who grew up poor in Abilene defied the right wing of his own party and said, should any political party attempt to abolish or tinker with Social Security, you would not hear of that party in the long run again in our political history. Nobody would have been more angry than Ike, who was proud of receiving Social Security, than recent attempts to undermine it. Ike has a certain reputation for garbled syntax in his speeches. But I have to say that on matters that concerned him, he spoke and wrote with the clarity that always characterized his orders. For example, on a subject that concerns us all today, we would do well perhaps to listen to what Ike, a great general, had to say. The United States has no business transforming itself into an occupying power in a seething Arab world. I'm sure we would regret it. I don't think anybody could have put it better, and this from the man who had conquered Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia, and therefore knew whereof he spoke. It is time, I believe, to recognize not only Dwight D. Eisenhower's skill as a general, but his wisdom and humanity as a president, and to appreciate the extent to which the survival of America depended for so many years on his homespun virtues. Honesty, modesty, hard work, devotion to duty, personal courage. He was, I believe, a true American hero. It was a pleasure to write a book about him.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fodin. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Terry Pratchett, Whitley Strieber, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on September 27th, 2007.